Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Wi-Fi Tribe podcast. Today we have a bit of a different one where I was interviewed rather than doing the interviewing by our very own Amanda Scott. And she basically asked me about my background in environmental science, environmental policy. And we talked a lot about that and kind of my path to from doing that to working remotely and what I'm still working on in that field to this day. And I wasn't really expecting it, but it was kind of nice to talk about that, something which is my biggest passion. And she is a great interviewer. She's much better than I am. So I think she asked some great questions, and I think it was a pretty good conversation. So hope you enjoy. Here we are.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hi, Jordan. Hello.
Hi, Amanda. Manada.
So, hello, everybody, and welcome to today's podcast. The last time I was on the air, I was with Jordan, and he was interviewing me. So I thought it only fair, after doing a little bit of research, that we turn the tables and take the opportunity to get to know the man behind the voice of the Wi-Fi Tribe podcast. So we're going to just go into a little bit about Jordan, and then we're going to have a bit of a discussion today around the environment, sustainability. It's a topic that is hugely important to a lot of us in this community. And so it is really fantastic that we get to talk to Jordan today. So Jordan, thank you for being with us on today's podcast show and agreeing to let me cause havoc, at least just for a brief moment in time. So thanks.
Yeah, well, no one can say no to you, so you're welcome.
Plenty of people have said no to me, but it's fine. It's okay. So, so Jordan, just a little bit about your background. So obviously, one thing that is hugely prevalent in this community is that you'll see somebody in front of you, they'll be looking crazy with a man bun and they like basketball, but there's so much more to you than that. So when I was doing a little bit of research, I found that our very own Jordan, Wi-Fi Tribe chapter host, blog extraordinaire, voice of the Wi-Fi Tribe podcast, is actually practically a professor in environmental matters. So let's have a look at some of your credentials. So you've got a BA in environmental geography from the University of Calgary. Woo! Calgary. You've got a master's in sustainable environmental resources management from Malta. So how long were you in Malta for to complete that?
Just under a year.
Just under a year. So yeah. You complete the master's in a year, which is outrageous. And then a master's degree in integrated science and technology from James mm-hmm. Madison University. You've since gone on to, be selected for the Young Leaders for a Sustainable Future program, which is, a huge achievement. And you've also gotten involved in some stuff with the United Nations Green Corps for environmental professionals. You've been a consultant, you've been an athlete of two different sports, if I'm not mistaken, is basketball and American football. And you've lived in countries all over the world, that's quite the resume, Jordan, wouldn't you say?
Hearing you say it, it sounds all right, but I don't know. Living through it, it doesn't seem so crazy, but I did have an issue, though. What kind of led me to remote work, though, was uh-huh. when I tried to get the more of a office job in Calgary, when I said I wanted to, kind of plant some roots or whatever, uh-huh. I had a bunch of interviews because my resume looks decent, but then most of them were afraid that I wouldn't stay, I wouldn't want to to work in an office environment. They knew I wanted to move so
Yeah,
much
that is
that they,
true.
yeah, that was actually, it actually ends up being kind of a downside to the more traditional way of working. Which is, you know, in the end, that's a blessing, but it was also kind of frustrating because I like to succeed when I, you know, try to do something. So when I apply for a job and get an interview and they don't get it, even if the job wasn't for me, I mean, a couple of the jobs I didn't get, which led me to this new journey. Yeah, they wouldn't have been great. You know, like I had an interview for the climate change technician at the Calgary airport, which sounds cool, but I probably would have gone stir crazy in about 3 months or less. So, you know, just things like that. Everything kind of fits, and not to be cliche and say everything happens for a reason, but when everything happens, you can find reason in it, and you can, you know, move forward and find your path based on like what's happening. So it's kind of what's happened.
No, that's absolutely right. So I guess my next question is, like, that is, looking at even just like your academic credentials, like that is an extensive amount of focus on the environment and, the climate that we live in. So how have you always been interested in the environment? Like, where did that start? Was there like a trigger, or have you always just been naturally curious in that kind of way from when you were a kid? Like,
Yeah.
what's the backstory there?
So when I was a kid, I was very curious, and I was really big into science when I was little, and I developed really early as far as like reading and writing and school and stuff. So I was really big into dinosaurs especially, and I wanted to be a
Wow,
paleontologist.
okay.
I really, really wanted to be a paleontologist. I could spell Tyrannosaurus Rex when I was 4 years old. I could You know, I tried to read Jurassic Park the novel when I was 5 years old. It was definitely a bit too difficult, but I would, you know, read as much as I could, and I was just really into that. But then I discovered basketball and football after that, and I put all of that aside. I literally stopped caring about school. I got good enough grades just to be able to make it into university to play sports, but that was my only focus. And you know, I wanted to play professionally, and that's all I cared about. I put everything else aside. Until I hurt my knee playing basketball, which then really derailed my basketball and football career in college. And I saw how I was treated differently by the coaches who used to care about my grades and used to ask me how I was doing and used to, you know, cared about me. And then they just stopped. And it was a hit of real life in university, which I think a lot of people don't get. You know, I think a lot of people go through university and they're in the university environment, and then they get in the real world after. And I mean, sometimes you can just go to your job or whatever, and you don't, it's not a big deal. But for me, going from really treated nicely and catered to as an athlete, you know, the movies don't lie. How you are as an athlete at university is like you really get special treatment. And I loved it. But then to lose that was kind of like a wake-up call. And I was like, okay, I have a, you know, a year and a half, a year and a semester to finish my undergrad. I said, I'm gonna care about school now, and I'm gonna use, they're paying for my school, so I'll just use that and I'll get something out of this. I was kind of just like, you know, flipped it around. I was kind of like, F you to them. And I did. So my GPA went up from, you know, average to pretty decent and good enough to go to grad school. And then went and did that and did more than I thought I would. But I kind of reawakened that curiosity and that drive for scholarly things that was in me when I was young, which had been there the whole time. And it took me a long time though to balance athletics and academics as far as like identity, you know, like for a while I wanted nothing to do with football or basketball as far as like being perceived as an athlete, and you know, you aren't taken seriously if you're an athlete, if you're in the world of academics or whatever. So only recently I've been able to accept my love of all of it and not really care what people think of me for it.
Well, of course. So, because you mentioned that you hurt your knee whilst you were still in university, so did you Did you recover, or what happened there, or?
Yeah, that's the thing. I actually hurt my knee because I was playing two sports and was doing up to 60 hours a week of both those sports combined. And it was
Wow.
overuse, and I didn't stretch or take care of it good enough because it took up so much of my time already that I would have
Yes.
no social life and no time for school, even if I also did stretching and the proper maintenance. So yeah, it was just like an overusage, and I had tendonitis in my knees, and I had a slight little, I mean, technically my femur broke, but it wasn't like breaking your femur, which is life-threatening. It was like the tip of my femur where it connects to your patella, and
Right.
that had broke off, and it was just recovered on its own. It took about 6 months. But the thing
Yeah.
is, like, I could still walk, I could still move. I lost all my athleticism. So it was like a
Yeah.
really, it wasn't like an ACL tear where you're out, you get surgery, you recover. It was just like a downgrade to my physical condition.
Wow. Okay. So then it was a case of kind of finding solitude in like nerdy scientific, awesome, cool stuff then.
Yeah, and the funny thing about the environment, why I became interested in that was that, I mean, I've always hated waste. Like when I was young, if I had too many video games, it like bothered me. I was like, I'm not playing all these. I don't want them all. Like I only wanted to use what I had. I've always been like a kind of minimalist without knowing it, like the term or realizing. I just don't like to have a lot of stuff. Stuff clutters my mind. I don't like that. And then actually what happened was we went on a basketball team retreat to these cabins in like northern, well, not northern, like mid Canada on this lake. And we were in the middle of nowhere. I'm talking like 2 hours driving off the main road down a logging road and then hiking to this lake and then taking a boat across the lake to the other side. Like we were gone and there's no electricity. And like I was scared to death. I was a city boy, raised my whole life, like never really been camping. And that was like the first small thing that changed me, being like, hey, I like nature. I didn't even really realize this. Like I knew I liked trees, and I knew I liked being outside, but like I didn't know that I liked being out away from a city and like with that silence and that like real nature. So and that kind of coincided, like it was not long after that I hurt my knee, and I was like, what do I want to do? I didn't even know what major I wanted, whatever. And then I found this, I took some geography classes as just electives, and I love the emphasis on the environment. And I took class on sustainability, and I just thought that really fit in with what I'd always loved. Like, how do we be outside or enjoy and have our nature fix, and then not overuse things and not have a lot of waste and just basically exist in a way that I kind of always felt like spoke to me. And yeah, so I just
That's
kind of found
incredible.
that passion. And that's why I'm a big advocate for taking electives in university. Like a lot of people are like, oh, like why do you take these other things? Why can't we just take our core courses and be done? And I'm like, because you don't know what you want when you're 18, and nor should you. And you know, one of my favorite quotes ever from Michael Crichton in The Lost World, the follow-up to Jurassic Park, he said, nobody smart knows what they want to be until they're in their 20s and 30s. And I mean, when you're young, that sounds crazy, but it makes so much sense. Like, how do you know what you want to do with the rest of your life when you're 15 years old? Like, you shouldn't. You shouldn't until
100%.
you're like, yeah, in your 20s or even into your 30s. Or look at what we do now with this remote work. That didn't exist when we were young. So how could we know that we wanted this? We couldn't. And so taking electives allows you to find out and seek what you like. So if you're patient, or if you don't know and you go looking, that really allows you to find what you want. And that's what happened to me. Luckily, I'm so like grateful I had the opportunity to do that. Like I know most people don't even get the chance. Like I was very fortunate to be in that position, you know, like to even ask, you know, people like, oh, like what is the purpose of life and those kinds of questions. You can't even ask those unless you're doing so well and you're surviving so well that you have the time and the good fortune to be able to ask those questions.
No, that's really interesting actually. 'Cause I guess from knowing you, I kind of just always assumed like that you were always that kind of like jungle type kid, But to hear you say, oh, I was a city boy,
No, yeah.
I was so interested, like I was petrified what the hell is gonna happen, like No. That's really interesting. And I guess for all of us, we're part of the digital nomad community, and a lot of us have had this thing where we've followed a particular trajectory, and then it's likely that a lot of us are going to change our careers several times in our lifetime. Like, I think I was watching a just a quick like snippet video with Gary Vaynerchuk, and he was saying if young people could get the concept that they're going to live at least three or four lifetimes, they would, stop stressing out and be a bit more patient and take their time trying to figure out what it is that they want to do. And I didn't really understand, but I guess he's kind of got a point, because your life will go in seasons. It's not always just going to be, okay, I'll have this job and I'll do this job for, 50, 60 years. Like, there's so much more to it than that. So that's really interesting to hear. So, like, Jordan, I obviously, a lot of us in the digital nomad community, we're aware that we get on flights all the time. A lot of us, we like the finer things in life. And yet we're kind of, we're serious about this idea of sustainable travel, and finding ways to kind of protect the environment. How do you see like sustainability fitting in with the digital nomad lifestyle, bearing in mind that when we want to go somewhere, we get on a plane, we all love a cheap flight. We travel from continent to continent. It's expensive. It's pretty heavy on the environment. So where do you see that whole thing going, in terms of, the digital nomad lifestyle and sustainability? Is there a way to combine those two things, do you think?
Yeah, I think that almost everyone in the digital nomad community cares about sustainability, or at least, has the those kinds of thoughts, because kind of like I said before, we're very fortunate. And when you're fortunate, you have the time and you have the resources to be able to think about these things, right? Which is why, so planes are an example of, there's a lot of CO2 being put in the air, but a lot of the most impactful things on the environment, like plastic usage and just not putting the right care into what's needed, is actually by from people that can't afford to think about sustainability. Like they're thinking about, where is my next meal coming from? So obviously, like, the cheaper, easier option, if it comes in styrofoam, if it, like, that matters. And and you can't tell people. You can't come from a place of privilege and tell someone to stop using styrofoam and stop throwing it on the ground when, like, they're worried about surviving, right? So that's really tricky. And then, so I like the idea that we try to take responsibility for what we can do, but it can only do so much. So there's this thing I've been working on lately. I'm actually writing a paper about it right now, but I came up with this idea of a tripod of environmental sustainability. And I talked about this in Playa del Carmen at the Nomad Talk. And so basically, the first leg of the tripod is behavioral change. So that's us saying, we're not gonna go on flights. Okay, one of us, or even a bunch of us not taking flights, won't change anything, because the flights are still gonna go, right? And there's also this I think there's a misconception that I saw in an article that said only 1 in 5 people have ever been on an airplane. And so, like, we're disproportionately affecting how much, like, we're putting, how much carbon put in the air, because a very small number of people are flying, and that's what's causing this. But I can't, I would need to see the evidence for that. I don't think that's true, because, like, flying is not this thing now where you have to be like an upper class. Like, I'm sure like, how many people do you go to Jamaica and talk to anybody in, like, the country, like like cockpit country, they've been on an airplane 100%. They've gone to see family in Toronto or family in the UK. Like, it just, everyone's been on an airplane. I really don't believe that statistic. And I'm not gonna say it's untrue, because I want to see the evidence for that, because I have a hard time believing that. And I don't know where I didn't see any evidence when that was shown. Someone just said that. So I'm inclined to think that that's not the case. I think more people fly than we think because it's very accessible. It's not that expensive, right? Cheap flights, especially like think about within Colombia, you can fly places for like $20. You know, you can save up and fly for $20. One thing I've learned from couch surfing and from traveling, like people, especially younger people, everyone loves to travel and everyone does it regardless of your economic situation. Like people, that's a high priority. So, I mean, you see how everybody has a smartphone, almost everybody has traveled. So I just think that's not quite right that we are the problem. Now, it doesn't mean we can't do something about it. And I think that our community can band together and really do something. So the first thing is a behavioral change, but behavioral change only works if it leads to something bigger. So the reason why it's the first leg of the tripod is that behavioral change needs to then affect innovation. So by a bunch of us coming together and saying, hey, we don't want to do this, and like we're going to make these changes, that we're going to create demand for something else. So instead of just saying we're not going to fly and then you stop living your life the way you want it, we're going to be like, our behavioral changes and what we're demanding here is that something else comes along that can replace fossil fuel driven flight. So that'll spark innovation, which is the second leg of this tripod. So innovation will fill demand. So you're saying, okay, we want to fly, but we don't want to put carbon there because we're not liking this. So we're taking a stand and we're not boarding any flights that use carbon-based fuel. So businesses, or you know, based on the work of whether it's private or whether it's government funded, whatever, these new technologies that can then we can still fly. Like there's no reason that flight and pollution need to be tied. That's just the way it is because it's the way it has been, but it doesn't have to be that way. So already we've seen there's these small like short haul flights that can be run electrically. And
Really? Wow.
yeah, but that's not gonna solve the problem in itself, but like you know, like 15 seater, they're like private jet. They can be run on electricity. Now you can't go much bigger because there's issues with the batteries. There's issues with weight. There's issues with holding enough electricity to go for a long period of time. But it's a great little start, right? Like we can go from whatever LA to San Francisco on a one of these electric flights. That's a good thing. We can start getting rid of these short haul flights with these other options. Now there's a whole nother set or there's a whole nother range of fuels we could be using that are based on hydrogen and taking you can take CO2 actually out of the air and you can create a fuel out of that which will make it net carbon neutral. And so these actual the technologies themselves, it's a bit over my head because I don't specialize in on the technology side. I specialize more on the policy side. But what I've always done is worked with technologists and work with people who are more into the more molecular science of it and make the best decisions on what we should use. And that's where it's going. I mean, there's just so many options, but there needs to be such a demand for it that there's high investment, whether that's again private or
I see what
public.
you're saying
But
there. Okay.
yeah, so that needs to be driven by behavioral change. It needs to be driven by the demand. And then we'll have funding into these kinds of things. Because they exist, or if they don't exist yet, they're possible, right? So we need to move towards that. And that's why it is important for us to change our behavior, but it will not fix everything if we just don't board a flight. Like that doesn't fix the problem, but it does spark the thing which will then help us fix it. And then the third leg of this tripod is policy, because now you need regulation and you need help from laws to make sure that what you're doing covers all the bases. So what I mean by that is we get to a point, right, where we can realistically and have it cost competitive for us to run on non-CO2 emitting flights, okay? But it's not like if we left it up to just the behavioral change, the innovation, you're still gonna have some left over, right? There's gonna be some aspect or some part of the industry that's still gonna run fossil fuel flights because it's still profitable or for whatever reason. Policy needs to come in and go, okay, now we're at a point where we can run it on electric and these other, say, two other forms of fuel, and they work. And maybe it's slightly more expensive, but it's not outrageous and it's cost competitive and like we're in that realm. It's up to
Okay.
policy to come in and say now we can't, we're not allowed to use like CO2 emitting vehicles like that. We're at a point where we don't have to, so like we're not going to, and it's going to be banned. I think it's
Right.
phased out, or like policy is very important because it's like ensuring that it's acting in the right way, right? It's
Yeah.
like the third step.
Okay.
And then we've seen this everywhere in Canada. They made a policy to phase out coal power by 2030 in Alberta. So
Yeah.
what you need to do then is find something that can replace coal. So they've been working on a lot of different solutions because the policy came in. So that one, that's kind of like, and that's why it's a tripod and not like a I don't know, linear thing. It's that these three all need to exist together. And if one goes away, they can't stand with just the other two. And it can't stand with just one of them.
Yeah.
Because a policy without having any means to actually accomplish that policy just won't work, right?
Yeah.
And innovation only works if people are willing to change their behavior, if they're willing to have that demand for it, right? And then
Right.
have the policy that makes sure that we actually implement these things when we're capable of doing so. So those two
Okay.
things together, and a great example of this, the best example of all, which I'm going to include in my paper, is the banning of CFCs at the Montreal Protocol in 1987.
Right.
That's when we realized there was a problem with the hole in the ozone layer, and we realized that CFCs were the problem.
Yeah.
And it's probably the best success story in the international community, in regards to the environment at least, where CFCs were banned completely, which was a policy move because people were worried about there being a hole in the ozone layer, which is a very, very real thing to be worried about. And then the
Yes.
innovation came that they were able to find a different set of products that we use instead of CFCs in refrigerants and coolants, which is what CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons were used for mainly, found something that worked just as good that didn't put a hole in the ozone layer. So the policy amended, you weren't allowed to use CFCs, you had to use these other ones because people said they weren't going to do this anymore. And then the innovation came that, people working on this and research and development found things that worked just as good. The result was that it took a lot of time because changes in the environment are very slow. It took about 30 years, but just last year was the first increase in the amount of ozone that is covering the earth in the area they were measuring. So it took 30 years for it to stop and then reverse, but it has been reversing because of this ban. So it worked.
That's incredible.
Yeah, the thing to take
That
away
is
from this is
amazing.
it worked. It's possible to come together and actually help create a solution using these three, make sure all three of these things are used together. Now, the issue with CO2 is it's way more complex than CFCs. CFCs were used in like coolants, like refrigerating, and like aerosols, right? So that's not a huge portion of what we do every day. Meanwhile, driving, flying, plastics, all these things
Yes.
contribute quite a bit of CO2 in the air, and they're all very necessary for everyday life, as it is right now. So it's going to be a lot harder. That's going to create a
Okay.
lot more innovation over a larger space. So like I love what Elon Musk is doing with Tesla, and not just for it itself, but what it's doing is creating a whole market of electric cars because there's competitors. So
Yeah.
it's not that he's just going to fix the world. It's that Tesla is driving other innovation, and they're
Yeah.
driving, other car companies to create their own electric brands. And then once it becomes feasible enough to only drive electric, then it's going to be up to policy to say, now we're only allowing electric cars on the road, right? And then
Right.
making sure we get electricity from non-emitting sources, which is
Yeah.
going to be renewables, but also hopefully these SMR thorium reactors, which give a lot of non-emitting electricity. It's not renewable, but it also doesn't have the same radioactive and nuclear waste problems that traditional nuclear has. I could go on about that forever, but that's just, an example of what we could be doing and how, there isn't much we can do as an individual, but as a group, and we band together and we realize that our actions will lead to bigger things, that's the key thing to take away.
So what, because I've got a really kind of practical mind about these matters, because I think we can all talk about the philosophy and the bigger picture. But when you think about the digital nomad community and the kinds of people that are in it, do you think then that instead of say, okay, well, I'm not going to get on this flight, do you think that we could commit more of our resources not just being finances, but more of our creativity, more, being able to push forward and maybe get to a position where we're affecting this kind of policy? Do you think that digital nomads could maybe do a little bit more of that, or
Yes.
yeah,
Yes, and
so
I think it's more, I think it's energy better used than just saying I'm not taking a flight, because like that does work in large numbers, but what's even better is when you take your time and your energy and you put it towards pushing a solution further, like more pointed. It's just like someone, you can give money to charity, which is a good thing, but it's more impactful if you donate your time and actually go and do the stuff. Like getting out there and actually pushing things forward. I think this community would be really good at that. This community can band together and be, a few thousand people strong with, most people are very intelligent, are very good at really important areas that can affect this, like coding, like marketing, like it's just as big is or just as important to use those kinds of things to get the message across as it is to taking your own personal action. Like
So
someone
could
who's an
you?
amazing digital marketer can get the word out that there's an electric option if they want to fly from LA to San Francisco and then get
Brilliant.
everyone on board for that. That's going to drive the demand for it, which is going to drive innovation on that. And then like that is where change accelerates. And I think, yeah, I would love if we could have some sort of like plan and work together to do that.
It could
And
be like a they could be like a movement, like a almost like a passion project movement. So you focus on, okay, so I run like e-commerce business or whatever, but then you take like a portion of your time. So I guess it depends, like, because for me, I'm kind of thinking, right, well, I'm Amanda, I'm a writer, I'm not, not massively like affluent in terms of money wise, but this we all live on this planet. So what could I do? Like, what could I commit? I guess it's kind of turning that conversation to a point where if you've got a platform, every human being, I believe, has some kind of platform that they can use. It's not always necessarily about throwing money at it. I just, that's a really good point that you've made about. So say if you're okay, so fine, if you have got money, say you're an investor. Invest in stuff that's going to generate income, but also invest in things just because the principle behind it and the heart behind it is to maintain and make this world a better place. So you can have like a portion that does the capitalist stuff, and then a portion of it that goes towards, oh my God, there's a young lad in Nepal or whatever who has just created some kind of I don't know, some kind of contraption that means that they use solar light instead of gas, or they figured something out to power a little scooter for 10-year-olds or whatever. And we say, that's really cool. Let's invest in that because we've got the capacity to do that. And then someone who's a writer or has great networks in some of the major platforms that cover, the whole world, maybe we can do stuff with that. That's really cool. That's a really awesome concept. I actually really like that. Maybe we can start like a movement or something, Jordan. You could, maybe cause some mischief there. Just before we go, because I'm aware that time is running away from us. Obviously, I just wanted to highlight some of the things that you've been doing. And during my research, I discovered that you've got a little something going called Tree. So tell me a little bit more about that. Tell us, not just me, but tell us a little bit more about Tree, what your vision was with that. I'd love to, hear more about it.
Yeah, I guess I haven't told you much about Tree, I guess, right? Like I
No.
haven't spoke about it at all, so I can tell you without you pretending you don't know anything about it. You actually don't know.
I
So
actually don't know.
Tree was based on my thesis from Malta when I wanted to study the rainforest in Guyana. That's where I was working after my undergrad before I started grad school. And it just, that changed me to my core. That's where I became the man of the jungle, because I went to live there basically with only indigenous people and one dude from Georgetown. And we're out in the jungle at a research station. And they did forest monitoring. And I was a forest monitor and a tourism officer. Now, not very many people come to visit Guyana. It's mainly just British people who've seen everywhere else in the world. And it's like last on their list.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting. And I learned so much from the people. Like I learned so much from the guys who don't have degrees, but knew everything about every tree there and find their way without any map or compass or anything. And they'd be walking through the jungle. And at the same time, they're knowing where they're going and taking care of everything. They're like taking care of me. And they're slinging out my hammock, making sure my mosquito net is right so I don't get malaria, and making sure I don't walk into the trunks with thorns on them because I can't see them coming, you know, early on. And then I learned as I was there. But so I just loved it, and I wanted to study there. And I figured the best thing I could do was to combine what I was doing there and then research it. And basically combine that, being a tourism officer with a forest monitor. And forest monitors, like, you're monitoring the forest to see for like biodiversity and like water, that kind of stuff. So the idea was to see if tourism could actually improve conservation there. So if we could use money that was brought in from the tourism and put in the right areas, could increase conservation by using it to fund more patrolling of the borders, more education and training, and all that kind of stuff. If you use right, it actually does. Because the Nkrama Center that I was working at was losing funding from countries that were, you know, going through economic troubles. And there was a noticeable drop in what they were able to do as far as patrolling borders and stuff. It was creating a noticeable drop in biodiversity and water quality that we were studying. It stood to reason that if funded properly, it really helps, you know, the bottom line of actual conservation. But I wanted to study was, like, at what point is it detrimental? At what point is it too much tourism that's overrunning and then it's actually harming the environment? So I created this formula. Now, that's my contribution to original knowledge, original knowledge is that this formula where, like, how much tourism is good. And it came up about 25% of full capacity. So if you were to fill the Iwakrama research station with tourists about 25% of the time total, and take all the tours and do the stuff, and 75% of the time have it empty, that would give you the most money to lead to conservation and without harming the environment. This formula that I created that took me quite a while. So I took that and I went to work in Belize after that, and I was doing environmental education. So I was like going through the reefs and going through the jungles there and just, you know, educating on mostly the school groups from high school all the way to seniors in university and undergrad. And I really got to know that area really well. My vendors were used to the actual protected areas. And I thought I could maybe, you know, take what I learned in Guyana and put that to Belize. So I decided to create Tree. Which is essentially, it's ecotourism. It's a travel organization where everything we do leads to conservation. So you come have the adventure of time. You come swing off vines and jump in waterfalls and hike Mayan sites and go river tubing and eat great food and hang out with local people. Mm-hmm. And all the while, you're actually contributing to conservation, whether you want to or not, whether you care or not, whether you, you know, you don't need to do anything extra.
And just by being there, you help to. Okay.
And that's, I can't amazing. Help it. I lead all of them because we only do about 4 a year, and I try to fill them instead of doing like 10 a year. Because again, that leads into the less impact of actually doing the tours, but then getting the most out of them. So I try to do like 4 a year and get like, you know, good 12 to 20 people on the trips. And then I can't help but just educate on the trees and educate on sustainability and all the connections.
So
probably leave with, you know, at least if not a better understanding or just more mindful, and see how the mangroves in Belize affect you in Canada. Like, it's crazy, but these connections between all these ecosystems and these biomes, and they're not direct, they're very indirect, but just having that mindfulness or learning about those just things that you might not think are important, and then taking that. And my goal is twofold: to help the conservation of these areas, because I love Belize, I love Guyana, I love Jamaica. Those are the places we go right now. We're going to eventually expand to Panama, Colombia, and from there, I'm not sure, but those are the next two. But I want to help those areas stay conserved in the proper way. So sustainable development, which means you don't just stay away from them and like not go there, but you go and you visit responsibly, and you give back to not only for environmental sustainability, but economic sustainability for the local. All of that is tied together. And it's all with culture and, you know, what the environment means to everyone who lives there. And then the other side of it too is hopefully you take away some understanding on what you can do back home and how you can implement more sustainable practices just in your own life. And it worked really well with student groups. You know, I heard a lot of kids would go back and start a recycling program in their school, or, you know, give a presentation to their class on what they had learned. And like,
that's really amazing.
Things. And I wanted to continue that with trees. So, but I wanted to do it with just adults who would go back to like an office and do the same thing. And eventually I want to take student groups as well. That's a goal where we can go. But for right now, it's good just taking people who want to adventure and travel and care about the environment, and doing that in between Wi-Fi Tribe chapters, basically. Like, it's a busy, fun life.
Yeah. No, I bet. No, that's really cool to hear. And I'd, you know, love to see that expand. And, you know, obviously we, all of us are at Wi-Fi Tribe. We enjoy some, you know, incredible adventures in the places where we are, particularly, you know, if you're in South America, you know, if you've done like a Bolivia chapter, or you're in, well, in any of the South American countries, or you go in Asia and you get to explore all of these absolutely incredible places. And it'd be wonderful to have that kind of, have the opportunity to experience that from like an eco-tourism kind of side. I think that's a really dope idea, actually. Not for me per se, because I don't like insects, but that's an absolute no from me for the time being.
You're coming one day.
You know, I'm sure I could be convinced if I had enough wine. But you know, you can't be drunk for the whole time that you would be learning about the trees. I'd be screaming my head off. Say again.
Honestly, I honestly want you to experience it one day, because you might find a side of yourself you didn't know existed, and you might actually embrace that. And what I mean is that you can be different in the jungle. I will eat a piece of fish that's been out in the sun for 3 days, or, you know, something that's been sitting there and just not think about it and be fine. And like at home, I won't eat, you know, a piece of cooked chicken that's been out for 3 hours. Do you know what I mean? Like, you just kind of change how you approach things when you're in the jungle.
That is true.
Your real life doesn't exist there. And eventually, if you spend enough time there, like I did, it just meshes with your real life. And then it all becomes like one, and you change. You're just kind of a different person. So I really want you to come someday.
Someday, I'm sure I can be roped into doing something extraordinary like that. But I went to Jamaica a few years back, and we climbed Dunn's River. And I think, I don't know, someone might have been joking or whatever. I wasn't about to risk it, but they said that spiders would hang from the trees and that they were like crabs in the water. Now, I am not a particularly fast mover. Anybody that knows me knows that I'm not a particularly fast mover. I am a leisurely stroll kind of gal. You have never seen someone climb a river so fast. Like, I was up that, I was at the top and out of that hole experience before you. I didn't look. I didn't look to the left. I didn't look to the right. I didn't look in the water. I didn't look at the trees. I literally didn't look at anything. I was just like, I am getting out of here. So if anyone asks, they say, yeah. I was like, yeah, I climbed Don's River. It's great. But I did it as if Usain Bolt was my inner kind of, I don't know, coach or something, because I was up that, I was literally up that waterfall like, shoo, like I was a rocket.
That's such a waste. Do you know
I know.
How beautiful it is there? And like, it's one of the most beautiful touristy things I've ever seen. Like, there's a reason
I
why
know.
Because they're so beautiful, but this is like a thing where you don't mind how touristy it is because it's so beautiful, and you just ran through it because you were scared of a spider.
Not a spider, spiders. I think my dad is much more chill about these matters because he was you know, raised in a bit more of a rural environment for the early years of his life. But yeah, when I went to visit his family a few years back, they were like communities of spiders. They would stretch from tree to tree and their webs would all be interconnected. And, you know, I took a good look at that, Jordan, and I said, no, thank you. So I think I'm going to have to be one of those people that invests in sustainability by, I don't know, sponsoring a young person that has created some kind of contraption that's got the potential to save whole communities, and maybe putting them through university or something, because I can't see it. But, you know, maybe we all change, we all do different things and enter different seasons of our lives. But anyway, thank you so much, Jordan, for your time. It's been really, really interesting to explore this this whole topic with you. And I think, I guess the call to action for all of us in the digital nomad community is, how can we take a portion of our internal and our external resources and commit to making the world a better place, so that it's actually around not just for us to enjoy, but for future generations to enjoy. So yeah, thank you so much, Jordan.
Yeah, thank you. And that was very well put, what you just said as well. there's a lot of things that we can do, right? Banding together is one of the best things because there's strength in numbers. You know, when you travel, not only being mindful, but making sure what you put your dollars towards, not just voting with your dollar by saying, I'm not taking this flight and doing something else, but like making sure it's for a cause. Like don't skip that flight and whatever. It's not going to do anything. Make sure that what we're doing actually will help the mission go forward. And like things like tree, any type of sustainable travel or things that contribute to local conservation, whether that be economic sustainability, environmental, all of it together. Those things I think are good ideas. And investing, if you're able, with your time and energy just as much as your money is very important, especially for the gifted people that are in this community. I mean, every new person I meet in this community, most people are blown away by how good they are at what they do and how successful people are and how little people brag. It's just incredible.
It is amazing, and I can absolutely vouch for that. You can find Jordan on Instagram. He's getting better at posting. I think it's j.flagdime. We'll put it in the blurb so you can see. You can find out more about his organization Tree at treeexploration.com. And also you can find out more about the Wi-Fi Tribe community and the kind of mischief that we get up to at wifitribe.co. So yeah, thank you for joining us on this episode. We're gonna see you again, or spend time with you again, be broadcasted out of a speaker into your earphones in a room near you very shortly. We'll see you again soon. Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.